make it public. Okay. I guess I'll start with a kind of an autobiography.
Okay. Do you want to say who your name is in the comments? So if we do share it, people know who you are.
Well, I'm Sylvan Bayer in the comments.
Okay. Why did you pick that name? I like that name.
Oh, well, when my son was young, he liked to play with me and pretend I was a bear.
Oh.
And so I'd wrestle, you know, we'd wrestle, you know, how you do with little kids.
Yeah.
And also, his mom and I didn't get along so well. Oh. So, we would have some pretty nasty arguments. And so she called me a bear. Because I would growl, you know, that's what my Jung would call my shadow side is a bear.
Okay.
I growl. When I'm angry, I growl.
Okay. And
so anyway, it seems to describe a lot about my character. So.
Okay. Okay.
And you know how it is when you go online, you don't always want to reveal, you know, everything about you. So you pick something that seems to match.
That sounds fine. So go ahead with the autobiography.
All right. Well, I'll start with a little history. My mother's father was a fundamentalist Christian, and his ancestry goes way back. They were French, way back in the 16th century. And he was in Virginia by 1685. And over the years, I guess my mother's father's line kind of diluted. And so I don't think they stuck with the French Protestant as such. I don't know whether there is such a church. I guess it's a Calvinist church, right?
The Huguenots, the French yeah, Huguenots, right. Yeah, they were Calvinists.
Well, anyway, he wound up in some less traditional church, but, you know, probably something that came up in the 19th century. My mother's line come from Quakers, and they also arrived in the New World in 1685, but in New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
So that filtered all the way down. So that's one side. My father's Jewish, secular. He never went to temple. His father never went to temple, but, you know, they're ethnically Jewish. So my mother and my father married in Los Angeles right before World War II began, or before America entered the war. And I guess they were each kind of leaving or looking for something outside of their families, because there were certain aspects of each of their families that were less than pleasant. When I didn't have any, my parents didn't give me any religious training, hardly ever talked about it, except for when my mother would mention her father, or sometimes when we visited him. But when I was about three, we moved from Los Angeles to a suburb called Gardena, and next door were this big family of Catholics. and most of them were little girls. So they thought it would be fun to teach me Catholicism. So they began catechism. And of course, I was so little, I didn't really understand.
Sure.
But what I did get out of it is how sweet they were and how, you know, nurturing. But then my father apparently called, he didn't want them to do that. They called a halt to that. So, yeah. Okay, well, later we moved from Southern California to Northern California. And for whatever reason, although my mom hadn't said anything about it before, she decided I should have some religious training, or, you know, be exposed to it. So my brother and I were sent to this Baptist church, nearby Baptist church. My parents never went. They just sent us off. And so, you know, I went, and it was Sunday school mostly, but there was a church too. And I'll tell you, the way the stories, most of the stories were from the Old Testament. There was some New Testament stuff, but I'll start with what they didn't seem either true or false to me at the time. They just seemed like stories. And what really impressed me the most, I think they were, the way they were presented was with some coloring book or something like that, some illustrated pictures. The colors in the pictures were very vivid, and it gave a sense of agricultural life, because the Jews then were basically agricultural. And so it seemed, I'll add, at the time I was growing up, Marin County was still, it had a lot of open land in it. It was still agricultural. So there was, and also my mother's people lived in the country for a while. So what I'm getting at is that I think what I saw in the Bible was something that harkened back to an agricultural age and to America as a more agricultural society. Mm-hmm. Then there were also the New Testament stories. What I remember most of those are the Beatitudes, because they were like an instruction, you got a sense of what it was to be blessed, obviously, and there was a series of things that comprised this. So that struck me more than the other, the narrative, because it was a teaching. Although I was also aware of, like, when Jesus was in the temple, because he was 12 then, and I was 12 when I was exposed to these. And so there was kind of he's in there and he's engaged with the rabbis and they're having, he's trying to draw out of Judaism what's the core of it, the spirit behind the law, you might say. All right. Well, that's pretty much my religious background, but a few years later, I kind of just threw it away. I started reading Plato, and so Socrates kind of became my hero, and Socrates inquires, whereas the way Christianity was presented to me was not as an inquiry. It was just a set of dogmas that you're supposed to believe, and that's that.
Where did you get that from, as opposed to all the Sunday school stories?
Oh, well, I also went to the church as well as to the Sunday school.
Okay, so Sunday school, you got the stories. Church, you got the dogma.
Right, exactly. And, so the preacher would get up there, and he wasn't super fire and brimstone, but he kind of leaned in that direction. It wasn't the charitable aspects were not really emphasized all that much. It was pretty much rule-based. At least that's how I understood it.
Yeah.
And I remember once, Jesus takes a whip and beats the money lenders in the temple.
Yeah.
And I made the mistake of saying, oh, he got mad at them, which was very different from, mild-mannered Jesus.
Right.
And the people in the church didn't like me saying that.
They got mad at you for saying Jesus got mad.
I think they took it to mean that I thought he went insane rather than angry.
Oh, okay. The other.
And of course, I didn't mean that. It was just 12-year-old. Anyway, to continue with the story. So the preacher asked me and my brother to join. And so we had to talk to my father about it. And my father really said, no, this is not going to happen. He he may not be an observant Jew, but he's definitely not a Christian. he's from that strain of Judaism that doesn't remember Christian, doesn't think of Christianity as an institution too fondly. So it kind of went into a hiatus, and then, as I said, a few years later, I started reading Plato and Aristotle, and it really spoke to me, because it was inquiry, and although this may be stretching it a bit, I mean, Socrates also underwent a kind of martyrdom for what he believed in, and that impressed me. So, I went along that line. I read more philosophy. And then when I went to college, I was in college for a while at Berkeley. Then all the, you know, the Vietnam War was raging then. So eventually I had to make a decision about that, and I became a conscientious objector. Now, all this time, I said, although I didn't stick in the church or anything like that, but I started listening to Bach. And I tell you, if that's for me is a transcendental experience, is Bach. Bach's music is just, you know, it's as close as I'm going to get to heaven, I think. At least I feel, when I listen to it, I feel just, you know, at home, All right, well, let's go on.
You never knew a man named Neil Hand at Berkeley, did you?
No.
Okay, because no, he was a good friend of mine. He was about your age, maybe a little older. He was super into music. He was here at the church for years, and you remind me a little bit of him, so keep going. I just wanted to He went to Berkeley, and so...
Oh, by the way, interrupt me anytime you think I'm becoming too solipsistic.
No, I love your story, so keep going. Okay. I'm enjoying it.
Good,
I had some popcorn. I got the soda.
Yeah, right. So as I said, I did alternative service as a conscientious objector, and I worked right across the street from the university at the California Health Department. So there was this old guy there named Lou, and he knew a lot about Eastern philosophy. And I guess I should mention one thing, which if we do go public, maybe we want to edit this out. I did experiment with marijuana and LSD. The only reason I mentioned that, I know looking back on it, believe me, I had to go through that hippie stage. And
not the first one on my channel to admit to that.
Probably not. But the
Nathan
only
Jacobs basically said it all.
I know. And the real relevance of that is, though, I got this book which was based on the Tao Te Ching and the Tibetan book on the dead. And it was supposed to guide you through your psychedelic experience. Well, the foreword to this, and then I got the real Tibetan Book of the Dead. The foreword was by Carl Gustav Jung. And that just started me. I said, wow, this is the real stuff. And also this fellow Lou, he said, you ought to start studying I had mentioned mandalas, and that perked him up. So he said, you really ought to start writing your dreams down. So that's what I did. And it just really matches with me. It's really my path. And I've had some, now I still stayed friends with some church people, but they were Episcopals. They were high church people because they were also organists and classical musicians. So, you know, the aesthetic side of the Christian, at least the high church tradition, really, oh, it's always appealed to me, But the, you know, and it was a great contrast to this kind of, you know, agricoy fundamentalist thing, which, I mean, some of the hymns were kind of nice, but it wasn't Bach, you know, there was no Bach there. So when I say I became attracted to Jung, you know, of course I read his reflections on Christianity, and there are a number of ways. Some of me, you know, he says, he's like Peterson. He says, I'm going to speak from a psychological point of view. I'm not going to make any claims about the metaphysics, but from the psychological point of view, the Christ symbol, it appears in people, you know, it appears to people, and it has a big influence. But of course, from Jung's point of view, it's part of what he calls the self, which is, you might call the internal God image, not a claim that it's God, but it's the image that throughout time and place and all places people have had of God, and Christ represents the light half of that. But from Jung's point of view, it's not complete without the dark half. Now, I don't know if you want to get into that, but I'll just...
I'm all just, ears, because I got to learn a lot more about Jung, and there's a whole bunch of people that want to teach me, and so I'm all ears.
Well, You know, since I've been listening to you, and I'm thinking back on Jung, I want to, if I speak about Jung, I don't want to do it in a way that is antagonistic or hostile or confrontational. I want to do it in a way that offers you things that you can find worth considering. And actually there are more parallels than I was aware of when I first studied Jung. But it's important, I think, to know there's his book Ion, A-I-O-N.
Yeah.
The section of it is a long discourse on Christ as a symbol of the self. And beyond that, Christ as he's symbolized by fishes, which apparently isn't a big deal for Christians anymore, the fish, except for what occurred in the dividing of the fish. But as a symbol, it was a very early symbol, and it kind of got superseded, I guess, by the crucifix. Anyway, Jung dwells a long, long, long time on that and says a lot about it. Some of his stuff is kind of dense to read, and I know I don't know how you read as much as you do. How do you do it?
I don't read that much. I listen to a ton. I do a lot of audiobooks when I'm driving, when I'm doing chores around the house, when I'm walking to work. I do a ton of audiobooks.
Because you're always talking about all these different things you've read.
I've had a few years to read stuff, so this is not
true.
Just what I'm reading now. It's what I've read years ago. So
this is true. This is true. Yes, I understand.
Yeah, you're not young either, so you know, same thing for you.
I'm older than you are. Yes, I've had time to read stuff too. So let me tell you a few dreams. Is that okay?
Sure.
It'll give you a sense of
their dreams. So not a lot of Americans talk about their dreams, except my wife. She
doesn't
tell me her dreams.
No, dreams are, it's sad that more people don't pay attention to dreams, but, you know.
Well, what do you think dreams are?
I'm pretty much what Jung and Peterson say, that there's the psyche, the human psyche is both nature and spirit. It's both personal and collective. So dreams are not just things you make up. Dreams appear to you just as objectively as what you receive through the senses. It's just that they present themselves in a way that seems confusing at first. But if you've looked at your dreams for a while, they actually do form a narrative structure. So maybe the closest analogy is a good novel or a good poem, you know, some kind of allegorical work. But dreams are not allegories, because allegories are contrived. Symbols appear naturally, just as naturally as I say, the things you receive through the senses. Okay, so the first one I want to tell you, I was, one of the women where I worked was a Catholic, and she had gone to a Catholic girls' school in the East Bay. Excuse me, I have to refresh my notes. So I had a dream that there were what I thought was like the chapel of this college, and there were a number of people kind of milling around in a somewhat distressed fashion. There was a crowd of people, but on the top of the entry to the chapel was a statue of the Virgin Mary, and she was very sorrowful and compassionate, Mater Dolorosa, very caring, but also very sorrowful. Now, I know you like to say that the church is the bride of Christ. And
well, that's what the book of Revelation says. So.
Yes, I know. But if the church is the bride of Christ, she's a somewhat wayward bride.
This is true. That's what the book of Ezekiel says.
because, you know, the history of the church, do I have to tell you? I try to part myself from my father's one-sided view of it, but I can't altogether. I mean, it's just, and there's the other side, as all these people were milling around, and the thing is, whatever else it is, it's an institution full of people who are in a somewhat hurly-burly state. And I'm a very, very much an introvert, and I don't like crowds. I always find, ever since I was a kid, when I was 6 years old, I saw a bunch of older boys fighting. There was a group of them, and although it didn't involve me, they were in front of me, and they were going around in this vicious circle, and they were fighting. And that's been my feeling about crowds ever since. Hmm. I just don't like it. So this, you know, the Virgin Mary, although she was overlooking these people, she was singular. And I also think of the Virgin Mary as not an allegory, but as a Jungian symbol. And so she's much more personal to me than a representation of a church, which is a collective thing. And I'm also, you know, the sorrowful aspect comes out in Michelangelo's Pietà, of course, which is in a way, her own crucifixion, in a certain way of speaking. That touches me much more than the figure of Christ himself. Though I did have another dream where the two were on crosses facing each other. And it was unclear to me whether she was functioning more as a mother then or as more as a companion, that I never could figure that out. All
right. Now, tell me a little bit about, have you sort of trained yourself now to recall your dreams? Because one of the funny things about dreams is that when I wake up, if I think about my dream, my conscious mind almost immediately tries to work to shape that dream and make sense of that dream. In other words, there's the dream itself, and then there's me being conscious of the dream, and that consciousness is not, that consciousness messes with the dream.
It already starts to interpret.
Right.
Okay, it takes a lot of training. And what I did when I was young, at first I would just write them down. I wouldn't even think about them. And the dream I just told you about, the Virgin Mary, that did not come at the very beginning. I did a lot of dream work before I got to there. So when I was young, and this started in my early 20s. So I, you know, at that point in my life, I did train myself just to let the dream be the dream and wait and then write it down. And boy, sometimes I would fill 5 pages writing one dream down.
Wow.
So the point I'm trying to make is that I really stuck to the dream itself. Now that I'm older, unfortunately, I'm lazier, and I do tend to let my interpretations come right away, which is silly, but it doesn't matter because my dreams are not as profound as they used to be. They're just
really, it's interesting.
Yeah, really. I'm sure as I get closer to death, things will perk up again. But at this point, okay. Then the next dream I had is in a similar vein. Well, it wasn't the next night, but I was in a cathedral, and there are two sections. In the first section, another crowd of people were all lining up to go up this high throne, and on top of the throne was the Pope. And again, there was this sense of hurly-burly. They were all very obeisant. They were all rushed off doing their own thing. So, and this didn't satisfy me. So I went through to another part of the cathedral, and there was nobody there. It was quiet. It was like a real Gothic cathedral, high arches, and it was all so quiet and it was still. And I got a real profound sense of peace. And I knew that this was the way I wanted to relate to the transcendent, was through this quietness. And the architecture was so intricate and so at the same time almost resonant and alive. It was truly amazing, truly amazing. So, and then the third one I mentioned, again, the contrast between the depths of a spiritual experience and the crowds. This time I was with my father's father, who's, as I say, Jewish. I was playing for him one of Bach's pieces from the Well-Tempered Clavier, the Prelude in F major. I don't know whether you know it, but so it was very intense. I was truly involved in it. And I looked up at it and I saw him, and there was just this marvelous understanding between us. We smiled at each other, and you know, it was really beautiful. So that went on for a little while. Then later we became aware off in the distance was a rabbi who was talking to a bunch of people. And again, it was this sense of everybody's in a hurly-burly, and it seemed so superficial compared to what my grandfather and I were doing. Now, another reason why I would mention that, you know, I had a hard time with you at first, but once you said you hoped, you had your hope for heaven, and what you wanted to meet your father again when you went to heaven. And that just hit me like a bolt of lightning. I said, wow, this guy's really serious. He really believes this. This is truly his vocation. And regardless what I think about Christianity, he is, you know, this was his whole pathos, his whole being is in this. So I resonate with that. And again, I'm not about ready to sign up, but I, because again, and another thing, I think pluralism is very important. So, and I do believe that there are various paths to experiencing God, but I am convinced that you're dedicated to yours, and it's so meaningful to you that I can't help but admire that.
Well, thank you. But why wouldn't, I don't see that that's such a, I mean, people often say to me, they're surprised by that. And I think, I don't know why. Why aren't, I see lots of people who are, you know, some people are a little fuzzy on a bunch of things, but people seem to be pretty committed and sincere about their faith. I don't find that to be anything meaningful at all.
But is a big part of their faith meeting their family, their parents?
I think so. That's my experience anyway with many Christians, many believers sincerely, especially when they get later on in life, they very much anticipate reunion with their loved ones. That's a big part of the Christian faith, at least. And now it's not, see, part of the problem is that we live in this media saturated place, which are these images that are commercially derived and forced on people that, oh, this is Christianity. But if you're actually in a church, people are people, you know, they just are. And it's, well, very different from the people you see on TV.
Okay. The reason I found you was, I mean, I came across Peterson, of course.
Right.
And what was so attractive, I mean, I understand that a lot of young people are turning to Peterson because he's offering them a way to improve their lives.
Yeah.
But I'm not looking for that in him. What I found in him is that he's kind of what I would consider to be a modern exponent of Jung. Mm. He's brought Jung to a modern audience.
That's true.
And art and myths, you know, more broadly speaking. Well, that's what attracted, you know, I mean, I certainly wouldn't call myself a fan. Although, and there's also the political aspect. I mean, I hate the left wing. There's just no getting around it.
Really? The guy who went to Berkeley and was a conscientious objector?
Hippiedom has left its mark on me, as you can see. But over the years, well, first I became a libertarian, and then I've become more conservative because tradition is, oh, I'll tell you another dream. I used to have these dreams, quite a few. I would be like walking down an ordinary street, and all of a sudden I would get this intense feeling. And I said, I know that I'm a Jew, but it was just a feeling of being connected to something thousands of years old. Now, I'd never read the Torah. I only been to temple once with a friend just to see it. I mean, you know, I don't know any Hebrew, so, you know, I'm definitely not that kind of Jew, but in the core of me is still something Jewish.
Now, so you've got these dreams, and they, I mean, especially the first three, the sense of the hurly-burly, the religious. Now, when you lay it out that way, is it kind of the so there's something very much in terms of the distasteful about the religious. There's something
distasteful and superficial.
Superficial. Okay, that's the word. That's the word.
Yeah, it seems. I mean, all those people going up to kiss the ring. The Pope's ring. I mean, I didn't doubt their sincerity, but it just didn't seem aesthetically very appealing. It just wasn't something I wanted to do.
Yet the fourth dream, very much a strong sense of identity. And
yeah.
That's interesting.
That's part of the reason I think I've grown into becoming conservative, because tradition, you know, is much more important to me. I mean, you know, I've seen these Verveke things and these rebel wisdom things. Okay, that's fine for all you. I mean, it's kind of new age, which, I mean, it has its place, and it's certainly more intellectually refined than just,
yeah,
you know, incense and patchouli oil. But it's, and I do understand, you know, especially younger people, they're just cast adrift. And that's sad. And there's probably not much I can do about that at this stage in my life, and being an introvert. So, you know, if they go off of these, wherever they're going, okay. Now, I'll tell you also, even though I'm not inclined to be a Christian, I'd rather see this whole country become Christian than what's going on now, because at least you're connected to something. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, not only, as you would put it, connected to God, but from my point of view, you're connected to tradition that's thousands of years old, and encourages people to be moral and responsible.
Yeah.
And there's just too much of this. I mean, I think 10 years ago, I would say to myself, how can it get worse? Well, every time I, you know, you get some news, it gets worse.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not good. It's not good.
Yeah. Now there is very much a sense of the chaotic right now. The thing is, when it's chaotic, you just don't have a sense of where it's going to go. And part of how it could go is very much in a bad direction. And
very much. I wouldn't be surprised. Well, I don't think I'll be around long enough to see the worst of it, but things could get bad. Things could get bad.
Yeah. Well, and part of it is, you know, there's a sense in which, I mean, the technology is a big player in this. I've been reading this book on the Protestant Reformation and Erasmus and Luther, and thinking a lot about how the printing press functioned in that world. And you know, in that period, book burnings were a big thing. But part of how the printing press changed the world is you really couldn't outburn the printing press.
Good point.
And one place they burned all of, it was in England, and they were, you know, Tyndale was putting out a Bible in English, and they rounded up all the copies of the English Bible they could. And in fact, they were got to one point when they were buying them to be burned, and people, you know, the publishers just, well, this is great. You're just, you can't outburn the printing press. You just can't do it. And so,
right.
But you know, what we have now is the diversity of media. Just the chaos of it, and especially for people for whom there's so little, how can people come together? And, you know, it's similar to your dreams in that, how could people be together instead of, you know, have this hurly burly? it's going to be very, very difficult for the nation to find a narrative that it can rest with. So yeah,
I know some people like Jonathan Haidt are trying, but I don't know. I mean, somebody's got to try, but they may be, you know, trying to swim upstream. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I don't think I'll be around long enough to see what's going to go with that.
But now, besides Jung, you also often mention Hegel.
Now I did. Okay. Now we're, excuse me a minute.
Where does Hegel fit into this?
Oh, okay. I'll give a little history first. Believe it or not, I fell in with some Marxists.
Well, you were a conscientious objector at Berkeley. That doesn't sound surprising.
That's not when I fell in with them. This was later after, well, I was still working there, but I had finished the 2-year thing. I could go through a lot of diversions. I'll try to cut this one short. I had a friend. I lived in this co-educational boarding house. Through one of the fellows there, I met kind of a guy who was but he was a soft Marxist. He was a democratic socialist, not a Trotskyite or a revolutionary Marxist. He was a Norman Thomas socialist. Like, you know what that means? Social democrat, pretty much the democratic.
Yeah.
Hubert Humphrey. Say Hubert.
Yeah.
Okay. And I already become a libertarian by that time. So we talked and one day he came in, he found this book and he showed it to me called Jung and Politics. I said, oh, that's interesting. So I got myself a copy and I read it. And there was a chapter in there from that referenced a book called From Hegel to Marx. So I read that and that got me started on Hegel. Okay, where to start with Hegel? Hegel is very complex. You think Jung's a tough nut to crack. He's a child compared to Hegel.
Oh, wow.
And because, well, for one thing, Jung tries to be an empiricist and tries to explain things that he's experienced. Hegel, you know, he's pure thinking. He's a pure Kantian German idealist, and it's very, very abstract, and it's dense, because he's dealing with things that appear to be contradictions, and he's struggling to find a way that they are not contradictions. A lot of people think of Hegel as involved in this thesis, antithesis, synthesis. That's not Hegel, that's Fichte, and it's very superficial. His notion of Aufhebung, sublation, is that you have an entity, be it a thought or a social position, and it has its inherent contradictions. It's not that it's met with something from the outside that contradicts it. It's that as it develops, it develops its own fissures, let's call them. He didn't call them that, but I'll call them that. And through further development, a higher thought, a concept that embraces it all comes into being or develops. And that serves as a stage for the next series of internal contradictions that in the future, that subsequently become resolved themselves, and on and on and on. So now there's this Marxian interpretation that says that history goes on and on and on until some kind of utopia is reached. Hegel said history will never end because this development is the activity of what he calls spirit, which is something that developing from the simplest thing, the concepts of being and nothingness, goes all the way up through nature, through social relationships, through religion, and ultimately becomes aware of itself. And becoming aware of itself as spirit, See, before it was always involved in something like, you know, a rock or a tree or the family or civil society, the marketplace or the state or religious practices. But throughout all those stages of the journey, it was always, in a sense, external to itself. Through religion, especially through Christianity, because in all those polytheistic religions, all those gods are just kind of embodiments of natural forces and attitudes. In Christianity, God becomes aware of God, as it were. And through the suffering of the necessary diremption is the word that's used. And he even uses the word alienation, which may sound a little too strong. And then it's reconciled. Now, it's reconciled in the sacrifice and the subsequent, from Hegel's point and my point of view, is an image of a resurrection. Neither Hegel nor I thinks that the resurrection was a historical event, but that doesn't minimize its significance. But what happens is then Christ ceases to be, and he becomes something that has been, and now the Spirit dwells in the community of believers. So, and that's how it's perpetuated, according to Hegel. So, you know, you can take that or leave it, but that's in a very truncated form. That's what Hegel says.
Well, that's very helpful. I know a little bit of Hegel from, you know.
I do want to take issue with
Hegel, but from listening to summaries.
Exactly.
Of Hegel, and this very much really, is in line with a lot of other summaries I've heard.
I really want to take issue with those people, including Christians, who think he's a pantheist. He is not a pantheist. Because for one thing, pantheism is the doctrine that everything is substance and God is a substance. In the sense that God becomes manifest in the world, you could say he's a substance.
God is pure Geist.
Yeah, which is both subject and substance.
Right.
Yeah. So I just want to make, you know, I mean, you can still quibble with a lot of Hegel, you know, but I really want to clear that up, because my brother is still a fundamentalist. And, you know, that's, we both had to work pretty hard on remaining good brother relationships, mm-hmm. despite our differences in. Well, he once introduced me to somebody in his church through email, and who thought he was a philosopher, but he kept repeating this thing that Hegel was a pantheist, and he just said it over and over and over again with no supporting evidence, and you know that irritated me, and so here's Lewis. Lewis says the same thing about Hegel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in the book Miracles. He claims that Hegel was a pantheist. And so that did not endure. Yeah, I don't have the book right here, what page it is. Maybe let's see if I have it in my notes. That did not endear me to Lewis.
Well, I'll have to ask Lewis about that when I get there.
Yeah, do that. Do that. Do that. I was going to go into some of my criticisms of his, Lewis's, the way he sets out nature against supernatural, but I don't think I'll do that now. I don't think it really, it doesn't fit in with the rest of the.
Yeah. We don't have that much time.
Yeah. Left. Right. And I'll just mention that the way guys like Peterson and Verbeke and Jung look at things, there isn't this big divide between nature and supernature. There's more of a continuity. Does that ring?
What is supernature for Peterson and Verbeke and Jung? See, my sense is more that
they don't use those concepts.
Right, right. I would agree that they don't use those concepts.
They would probably say, I guess Jung would say metaphysical versus empirical is probably what Jung would say.
And I guess with Jung, my question is always, what does he mean by the metaphysical? Because I was really struck when I read this, I don't know what, even how to describe that sort of autobiography that I read of his, which, hey, your dreams are, you tell your dreams better than he does. I got bored listening to his dreams. But you know, his encounters with Freud, I found fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
And the, you know, Jung would predict the report in the bookshelf. And of course, Freud didn't want anything to do with that. But Jung was comfortable with that. And I appreciate that about Jung, because what I often find with people, dismissive materialists like Freud, is that there's just so much willful blindness to so much common human experience.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And so, obviously, as a Christian, I don't necessarily have that filter. I'm much more comfortable with the supernatural, even plenty of supernatural I cannot account for. And I'm very comfortable with that because we're just human beings.
Jung would leave it as a mystery. He would say, the same way Peterson does. I can't speak to this.
Yeah. And I think Christians do poorly when they try to account for it all, because I think there's much we can't account for.
They wind up being inverse materialists. Yeah. I mean, you know, Sam Harris and some Christians have got a lot more in common than either one would admit. You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's another thing. Except for a few high church people I've met, most of the Christians I've known have been fundamentalists. And, you know, and I don't want to nag on my brother, because we do love each other, but still, there's just certain things we can't talk about because, he's much calmer now, but there was a period when he would go in the rant, and one time he was so carried away that he was shaking. Mm. And I looked at him and I said, "Greg, you're shaking," you know, and it wasn't pretty. So, you know. But again, he's older now he's a young earth Christian.
Okay.
And that's, you know, what can you say? I'm not sure that he's young earth, but he doesn't accept macroevolution.
Okay.
And I'm not so sure I'm so, well, what I said to him is, "Greg, you know, it's either true or it's not true. Frankly, I don't think it has much to do with the human spirit. Although now that I've listened to Peterson and some of these guys, maybe it has a little more to do with it than I thought, but I'm the jury's out on that one."
I've listened to some, you know, a guy like James Tour, who's a biochemist, when he talks about, I mean, there are some huge holes in, we don't know. We'd like to pretend we know.
Exactly. And, you know, that's my beef against a lot of what passes for, or I don't know what I should call it, natural science or scientism or what, but, you know, there's a lot of dogmatism in that too. And
yeah.
I just, you know. Yeah. So there we have it.
Well, this was fun. I love, you know, I really love conversations, especially first conversations with commenters that are really faithful commenters like yourself, because it's so much more fun to hear your voice and get a little sense of your story. Because if it's just a name, you begin to notice patterns with the names and what they're doing, but it's so much fun to hear you and get a sense of you.
Yeah, you certainly have you're a real extrovert. You really embrace people. Just before we go, how do you deal with your parishioners? I mean, what do you have? All kinds of parishioners?
It's a very diverse church.
All kinds of intellectual points of view and all kinds pathologies and hopes for a better life and all that.
It's a very small church with a very wide range of people.
Now, what do you really think the future of Christianity is institutional in this country? Or do you have any idea? Or are you just going to do what you're going to do and what happens, happens?
Yeah, I so lately I've been thinking a lot about boy, this is, you know, I do 2-hour videos, so I got to be careful. You know, I've, you know, in my Sunday school class yesterday, I was really thinking about this transition that happens between John the Baptist and Jesus, and the way Jesus conquers. Jesus changes the whole idea of what conquering means compared to what everyone was assuming in his day, and it all revolves around this idea of what Messiah was. And then I've been, you know, paying attention to the Protestant Reformation, because all the Peterson stuff has really made me say, okay, what happened there in the 16th century that really? And so I've been reading this book, and this book, Fatal Discord, has been one of the best books I've read to just give a sense of the mass movement that the Protestant Reformation was and some of the roots in it. And there was a real turning from this Roman Catholic sacramental tradition of, you know, we're moving the levers down below that have pulleys to the wheels of heaven, and we're dispensing these merits of the saints. And Luther comes along, and suddenly faith is this psychological thing. And through faith then, things come down. And so they're working on that. That all happens in the 16th century. And it's, you know, that, and that continues then to change the world. And I think we're in a period of time now where it is changing again. And it is sort of a, it is the sacramental aspects have to be reincorporated now into the psychological aspects. And I think in many ways, theology, even though the church tends to act like a conservative, you know, a slow moving tradition, so often what happens in theology and often in piety is before a lot of the philosophy and then the theology. And you really see that in Luther. And so these things move very slowly, yet turns can happen very quickly. And so I think we're in another period where things are going to change, and what that will do in the church is really hard to know, because I think broadly, you know, it's, and I think Peterson is right on this, it is hard to be a member of Western society and not just be deeply embedded in the Christian story.
Of course, naturally, yeah.
And so many people like Sam Harris are so much more Christian than they would ever want to admit. And Christians are even fundamentalist Christians are so much more secular than they would want to admit and deeply impacted. So there's a lot of sorting out that has to happen. And I think we're going to see a lot of change. Now, here's the thing. Like in the Protestant Reformation, change can be a bumpy road.
Oh, yes. So
we do live in interesting times. But they go, these changes also, in a sense, often happen slowly. So how we will see them in our lives, I don't know. My kids' lives, they'll see more. So. Anyway, we're out of time, but this has been fun. Yes. This has been so much fun.
So what do you want to do with it? I'm not sure whether
I will send it to you. You listen to it and let me know.
Okay.
Okay?
Right. That's what Thank you, Paul. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.